This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. On this election day, take a break from politics with theater, film, and music, including a conversation about the life, music, and cultural influence of the late Chuck Berry. Here's Berry in 1987 talking about his influences.
The main guy was Louis Jordan.
Louis Jordan.
Yeah, I wanted to sing like Nat Cole, with lyrics like Louis Jordan, with the swing of Benny Goodman.
Sound Ideas culture commentator and ISU English professor Bill McBride remembers the man often credited with creating rock and roll. Robots are taking over the Normal Theater, Laura Kennedy explains, and previews a new film festival. And John Norton talks with the guitarist of the not-forgotten band Mojo Stew about a Saturday reunion benefit concert. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's April 4th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from country financial representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. If you want to gauge the influence of Chuck Berry on American music and culture, look no further than John Lennon, who said if you tried to give rock and roll another name, you might have called it Chuck Berry. A memorial service will be held for Berry on April 9th in his hometown of St. Louis, with a public viewing from 8 a.m. to noon at the Pageant Theater. Berry died at the age of 90 on March 18th. Bill McBride is a rock aficionado. The ISU English professor has also taught about Berry in his cultural studies class and touches on Berry in a couple of upcoming publications. He's also Sound Ideas culture commentator. Bill, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas to talk about Chuck Berry.
Always great to be here, Mike.
Is John Lennon overstating Chuck Berry's role in the creation of rock and roll?
No and yes. So, you know, I've watched that video where he's on the Mike Douglas show and he's co-hosting with Yoko, and he is reading a cue card when he says that. Now, whether that was Mike Douglas's writers, I think John loved Chuck's work, and I've always loved that quote. Let's call it something else. You know, the actual name rock and roll is a euphemism for folks getting together romantically, and that is important about music and Chuck Berry.
Even if somebody else wrote it, John Lennon, I would imagine, if he didn't believe it, would not have said it.
Amen.
What about Rocket 88 and Ike Turner? That was in 51. Chuck Berry didn't have his first hit until 55.
Yeah, so, you know, he and Ike were kind of rivals, and sometimes Ike would have larger crowds around the St. Louis area, and but yeah, Rocket 88 is, you know, folks like to point to that as an early rock. You know, it gets slippery, the origins of things, the horizon of when actual rock and roll happened.
We'll talk about that nexus in musical history in just a moment, too. Tell me about Chuck Berry's path to music. Was he raised in a musical household?
So he comes from both slave and Native American roots. Great-great-grandparents were. His father was a Baptist preacher and sang and performed, and his mother also. And they had a piano in the house, and he had a Victrola, and he had a Philco radio, and he got in trouble because he would always be in the back of it trying to figure out where that noise is coming from.
So he was tearing the equipment
up. He was tearing it apart.
When Chuck had his first hit, white musicians were listening to black artists and vice versa. Chuck Berry's first hit in 55, Maybelline, was based on Ida Red from Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. And they reportedly heard that song from Jimmy Davis. Let's listen to Ida Red, and then we'll take a listen to Maybelline, and then we'll ask you about both of the songs. This is Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys and Ida Red.
Light in the parlor, fire in the great clock, on the mantelpiece, it's getting late. Curtains on the windows, snowy white, the parlor is pleasant on Sunday night. Ida Red, Ida Red, I'm a plum fool about Ida Red.
And now Maybelline by Chuck Berry.
Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true?
Maybelline by Chuck Berry, and Ida Red from Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. I'm Mike McCurdy in the studio with ISU English professor Bill McBride. Can you hear the similarities in those two songs?
Well, sure. And I mean, but I'm really struck by the way he would coin a term, motivating. You know, he's got lots of those, botheration, too much botheration. But certainly the music, but you could hear when you contrasted those two, that roaring, rip-roaring guitar, which almost sounds a little out of tune when it comes in. I mean, that's rock, too, is having that guitar right up front. And that's something that we hadn't really heard before.
And guitar solos in his music
and
as
guitar
well.
Solos, absolutely.
Yeah. Tell me about this nexus in music history in the mid-50s, where country like Bob Wills, rock and roll from Chuck Berry, along with rockabilly and blues, were all sort of hard to distinguish. You know, they eventually went on their separate paths, but tell me about that. It's not been really repeated either in musical history,
no,
at least not in the United States.
I want to go earlier, right? So because Chuck is listening to Glenn Miller, and they are being played on the black radio stations in East St. Louis, and that's where he's starting to hear some of this stuff. And if you think about some of the Glenn Miller, the Boogie Woogie stuff, he puts lyrics to some of those solos and tells his own American stories. He's so American. But yes, the connection of all those forms of music. He would sometimes dress up in a cowboy hat. And I'm going to sing some of these hillbilly songs to a black audience. And they ate it up.
Beyond the music, what separates Ida Red from Maybelline? Can we dissect the lyrics a little bit of Maybelline to get at what makes it rock and roll? Because Bob Wills isn't singing about the same things that Chuck Berry's singing about.
No, because Chuck's in his car. I mean, those car, you know, the car culture. So, you know, let's say 1949 is a crucial year when Catcher in the Rye comes out and Death of a Salesman, where you get these two main characters who are young and are part of this culture. Youth culture is kind of invented, and Chuck's right there. And he cashes in, if you will, on that. The car, you know, I want my freedom, you know, all those films also from the 50s. It really explodes then because there is disposable income, maybe not in the poorer parts of the town, but that's certainly what Chuck aspired to.
Well, and he's talking about, you know, Maybelline, won't you be true? I mean, she's two-timing.
Yeah.
You know, so we're talking about sex here. You mentioned the phrase rock and roll is a euphemism for sex. With Chuck's music, the sexuality wasn't just below the surface.
No.
It was sort of in your face. Was this a formula that Chuck, that worked for Chuck? Was Chuck actually writing a formula, or was he just writing about what he knew and what was going on in the lives of his teenage fans?
So, as you mentioned, I've taught the autobiography, which came out in 87. That was his great year when he also made Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, the terrific film. And in that book, you can see he is obsessed with sex, and it gets him in a lot of trouble.
Well, let's talk about some of his legal trouble. He was convicted of transporting a minor across state lines. There was also the allegations and eventual settlement involving Berry videotaping women in the bathroom of one of his nightclubs. How tarnishing is this to Chuck Berry's legacy?
So in 59, he was arrested under the Mann Act for bringing an Apache waitress, Janice Escalante, over the line to work in his club. When you go through the autobiography, you see that he watches folks. He's invited by a famous singer who he won't divulge into a dressing room to watch them engage. He did get caught doing that, and he also got caught with 62 grams of cannabis, although he claimed that he was always no alcohol, no drugs, but there was that. In fact, he took some time out in the early 70s, right after coming up to My Ding-a-Ling, which again is another sexually inflected song, to just hang out with the hippies. And he loved that. He kind of saw it as a flowering of what he started.
So, sure, he was no saint. He had some early non-sex-related brushes with the law early on, armed robbery, a trip to the reformatory, later tax evasion. Bill McBride has joined us in the past to talk about David Bowie. We've talked about film noir and Hitchcock. Today, we're talking about the life and influence on American culture of Chuck Berry. Tell me about Almost Grown. This is a song you wanted included today, and we'll take a listen in just a moment, but what should we listen for?
Well, again, it's that youth culture. Don't bother us. Leave us alone. This song, if you listen closely, you won't pick it out. You have to be told to look for him. But there's a teenaged Marvin Gaye singing in the background of this. This is, for me, the youth anthem, almost grown.
And it was an anthem in part made famous thanks to America, the film
absolutely.
American Graffiti.
Yes.
Almost grown is Chuck Berry. Almost grown, Chuck Berry. When you hear this song, what do you hear? What about what are the influences that you hear that shaped his music?
Okay, so we heard the outro of that song, none of the verse, and I'm not going to quibble because I love your show. But he's singing about leave us alone, leave kids alone, let them grow up on their own, and so on. Now you could hear that. Those Rocket 88, I mean, listen to that piano at the end there. And I just love that kind of doo-wop, although it's graduated past
sure.
50s doo-wop, that background singing. It's also Etta James and Harvey in the New Moon Glows, along with a young Marvin Gaye.
When it comes to influences, let's listen to what Chuck had to say on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. This is from November of 87.
When you were getting started, who did you...
Here. I tell you, the main guy was Louis Jordan.
Louis Jordan.
Yeah, I wanted to sing like Nat Cole, with lyrics like Louis Jordan, with the swing of Benny Goodman, with Carl Hogan on, with Charlie Christian on guitar.
Right.
Playing Carl Hogan's riffs, who was Louis Jordan.
Right.
And with the soul of Muddy Waters. Oh, I had it all mixed up.
That combination?
Yeah.
That's a nice blend.
Yeah.
Do you hear that in his music?
Well, I mean, you know, he's done his own research. He knows. That's everything I had to say. Yeah, Carl Hogan is the guitar player for Louis Jordan, and he adored him. You know, the only little thing he doesn't mention there is that he drives to Chicago and sees Muddy Waters in a club and goes up to him afterwards, and Muddy would talk to anyone. And he walked up there, and Muddy Waters sent him to Leonard
to Chess Records.
And that's the
Where he got his big break.
He got his break.
That was Chuck Berry talking with Johnny Carson in 87. Late in his career, he's more of a nostalgic act, but he gets a boost thanks to filmmaker Taylor Hackford. What's that? What's that story about?
Yeah, that's 87. And I saw, in fact, I was a graduate student at Buffalo, New York, right before that. And
we're talking about the documentary Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll.
Yes, we are. And I saw Chuck live on a bill. He liked to open and then leave with Fishbone and the Butthole Surfers.
Really?
Yeah. and Chuck was terrific. You know, and he had a pickup band. Some local Buffalo fellas were there. I think they were all fellas. And he played great. He played all of his hits. He talked to the audience, and he was gone.
What do you want to say about Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll by Taylor Hackford?
Well, I just love that that film. And because of the dynamic between Keith Richards and Chuck Berry. So there's always been a little, you know, resentment that the Stones cashed in much more than Chuck ever did on Chuck Berry's music. And you can see that with Keith Richards as the musical director, he's trying to play Carol, and Chuck will not agree, say, no, you are not bending the notes properly. No matter what Keith does, Chuck is going to say, no, you're not getting it. And in fact, Chuck knocked him out, Keith Richards out once backstage because of... Because Chuck was with a white girl and Keith said something about it. And Chuck, who was a boxer and a hairdresser, which I love that about rock and
sure.
roll, too. You know, Little Richard was a hairdresser.
His boxing career lasted about that long.
Yeah,
though.
No, yeah, he got knocked out.
He got
yeah.
a beat down.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's end with another song that you think is important. And it's thanks to another influence, Nat King Cole. Why
yes.
is Havana Moon important to you?
Oh, so this is based on Calypso Blues by Nat King Cole. And this song, in a one way, goes nowhere. It's the same riff over and over again.
Well, but that's why I thought it was odd that you liked it, because it did. You're right. It didn't seem to go anywhere for me either.
I think it's gorgeous. Let's listen.
American girl, come back to me. We'll sail away across the sea. We'll dock in New York, the building's high. We find a home up in the sky. Havana Moon.
Havana Moon, Chuck Berry. Bill, what do you want to say about this song?
So it's got that great, several pop songs have this kind of, you know, that song Silhouettes on the Shade, where a guy is angry that his girl, he can see the silhouette on the shade, and then he realizes he's on the wrong block. So this one, Chuck's persona in this song is waiting for his American girl to come to Havana to come get him on a boat. And she doesn't come, and he drinks rum, he falls asleep. He wakes up in the morning and sees her boat headed back to America without him. And I just love that kind of, you know, ironic O. Henry ending there.
All right, Bill, thanks for joining us to talk about Chuck Berry's life and music. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
Bill McBride is an English professor. His teaching interests include film, drama, and cultural theory. He's also taught and written about Chuck Berry. The rock and roll icon died at the age of 90 on March 18th. A public memorial service is scheduled for April 9th. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Me lay down alone, was good to rum. Me fall asleep, the boat she come. The girl she look to come.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Normal Theater goes high-tech for a film festival that explores our sometimes bumpy connection with robots. Laura Kennedy has more.
Androids, cyborgs, robots, AIs. Call them what you will, but you have to acknowledge our complex relationship with our high-tech counterparts. Rick Valentin from Illinois State University's Arts Technology Department invites you to explore the cinematic history of our strange love affair with robots in a film festival running this week at the Normal Theater. Valentin finds our relationships with robots so varied and compelling that when titling this fest, Robots, he insisted on including an exclamation point.
It's not just that sort of 1950s or even 1920s reaction to robotics where
people were freaked out.
Yeah, there's always a little bit of fear, excitement and fear, classic science fiction combination, right? But the modern day, right now, I think this is one of the huge things we're talking about.
Seriously, we're still a little freaked out about, I mean, we're talking robots, cyborgs, androids, everybody under that big tech umbrella. We're still freaked out about this?
I think so. And now, because it feels like it's a couple of weeks away as opposed to 10 years away or 50 years away or 100 years away, we've been promised robots for a long time. And so in some ways, people are kind of used to the idea. And because of these films that we have in the festival, they've explored and gone through a lot of thoughts and possible scenarios because of these films. But now it doesn't seem so much as fiction. It's just kind of like, oh, yeah, what's going to happen when I have a robot housemate or I have a self-driving car? Even just your car will be a robot in a way, right? It will be intelligent and making decisions for you, and you'll kind of give yourself over to a car, which Knight Rider.
It's not something we're used to.
Yeah. I mean,
Knight Rider. Yeah,
exactly. I think of you know, David Hasselhoff and Knight Rider and all that kind of stuff, and that's kind of funny and fun. But then when you actually start exploring it and thinking deeper, you go, ooh, that is a little weird. Like, what if I get a free self-driving car, but then it always drives me by Krispy Kreme donuts every day because the advertisers have paid to have your route, you know, by their store or their billboards and everything like that. It starts, it's a little more disturbing than I thought it would be.
But it's not just the technology that maybe is disturbing to us today. It's the speed at which the technology is coming to us. We as humans maybe aren't as adaptive to it as quickly as we think we are.
I think we adapt, but we don't have time to think. I think you're right about that, is that things are happening so quickly. No one did a survey in 2007 and said, would you like a little tiny computer in your pocket that does everything and controls your life and you spend, you know, half of your day with it in front of your face? Well, actually, if somebody did a little interview with me about my smartphone or about the potential of a smartphone, I would have said, I want that. We always kind of just say, oh, yeah, that's a cool thing. We want it. And we don't really spend a lot of time.
We don't think about the ramifications of it.
Yeah. We never had a big meeting, a town hall meeting, a universal world meeting about, ooh, smartphones. Is that a good idea? And so at least with science fiction, right, that's the one outlet it seems like we have to explore these ideas. And in the past, though, science fiction, it was like, oh, well, this is 50 years out. And now it's really starting to seem like, oh, yeah, this is good. Good somebody thought about this in the 1950s and the 1970s and the 1980s, because now we're actually going to have to think about it because we don't have time. It's already here.
Well, speaking of the 1950s, let's start off with your first film, which will be running on the 4th at 7 p.m. at the Normal Theater. You've chosen Forbidden Planet and, of course, creating quite a sensation in this sci-fi version of Shakespeare's Tempest is Robbie the Robot.
What's great about Robbie the Robot is he's not the malevolent sort of robot that we're used to. He's dangerous, he's a powerful tool, and he's a servant.
Welcome to Altair 4, gentlemen. I am to transport you to the residence. If you do not speak English, I am at your disposal with 187 other languages along with their various dialects and sub-tongues.
You are a robot, aren't you?
That is correct, sir. For your convenience, I am monitored to respond to the name Robbie.
He's much more sort of sympathetic, I would say, and helpful in kind of that early idea of a robot. And Forbidden Planet in of itself is really, you know, ruminating about human intelligence and can we handle this power and everything like that. And so Robbie is not the source of trouble. We are. And so that's what's
But
really,
aren't we always?
Yeah, exactly. And so that's the idea that always comes up again and again, is that we're the ones creating these robots. We're gods trying to, or acting as God, trying to create versions of ourselves, and we make mistakes, right? And so it always does boil down to us and the tools we've made or these machines that we've made in our own image, but then they go horribly awry in some way.
Robot movie fun fact, though, this is the first entirely electronic commercial film score that was ever done.
Yeah, and so for me, you know, with a music background and a technology background, the soundtrack is amazing. Initially, the composers were supposed to just do the special effects for the film, and they just kind of went all out and, you know, did a whole soundtrack for the film, even though they weren't asked to do that. It's an amazing blending of sci-fi sound effects and then avant-garde tape-based composition.
Well, you're also showing the final cut of Blade Runner. That'll be on the 5th. And this is going to be the final theatrical showing. They're going to embargo this film because the sequel, Blade Runner 2046, will be coming out shortly. So get your tickets for this one.
Yeah, it's your last chance. I have mixed feelings. I'm somewhat excited about the sequel, but I'm also worried about it. You just never know. And so, yeah, this is kind of the last chance to see Blade Runner before it either gets enhanced in a positive way or reduced by a reimagining, a sequel, a reconfiguration of it. So, yeah, and honestly, any opportunity to see the original Blade Runner on a big screen is a wonderful opportunity because it holds up. It's really the apex of special effects in that era, and I'd say almost any era before everything became computerized. Again, I'm a computer person. I love computer effects, but there's something about that traditional analog effects that they use in Blade Runner that's really just beautiful. It's a beautiful film to watch, and thematically, it's an amazing film, too.
So what is Ridley Scott? What is his take on artificial intelligence, on robots, androids, cyborgs? So what is Ridley Scott saying about this technology mixing in with humans?
It's partly Ridley Scott's vision and then Philip K. Dick's vision, where the lines start blurring, where if it looks like a human, you infuse it with emotions and you have it act like a human.
She doesn't know.
She's beginning to suspect, I think.
Suspect? How can it not know what it is?
Commerce is our goal here at Tyrell. More human than human is our motto. Rachel is an experiment, nothing more.
Why is it different than a human? You know, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it is a duck, which is a horrible reduction of the film, but it is kind of it is kind of the theme, is the question. And so you have someone, you know, Harrison Ford, who, depending on the version you watch, is questioning his, or you question even his humanity, but it's even in that abstraction where he is basically assassinating these robots. And then the question is if they feel real and they act real and they seem to have real memories, then how is that different than murder? This is a moral issue that we're going to be struggling with, even with genetic modification and creating life in the laboratory and all those types of things. It's not simply robots. It's these questions of if a company makes a humanoid person, is that a object or is it an actual independent life form that we need to, you know, deal with in the same way we deal with a living being.
You're also showing Westworld on the 6th. The original, we're talking about the from the 1970s, that has Yul Brynner in it. And, of course, it has new life now on HBO as a series. Why did you choose Westworld?
Well, for that reason, I love Westworld. Just because when I saw it as a kid, it was that first...
Did it scare you? Because it scared the bejesus out of me.
It scared me a lot. Yeah, and that's what I'm also remembering. I'm thinking, oh, maybe my kids can watch this. And I'm like, oh, no, they can't, because I saw it on TV and they would hack it up. So yes. It wasn't as bad. And it was terrifying.
Even then.
Hacked up for TV. Yeah. Yes. It's a great example of... that classic, I guess it would be classic Michael Crichton narrative, which is you have these complex systems, whether or not it's a computer system or a biological system.
Nothing can possibly go wrong.
I'm shot.
Go wrong.
Raw.
Go wrong.
Oh my God.
Shut down. Shut down.
Oh, an amusement park gone awry, right? So Jurassic Park, same theme. But with the robotics, it's that same idea. We've created something, but what happens when something goes wrong? The unpredictable. And so then looking at how... that's viewed in that 70s perspective of, oh, we've got these big systems we're building that we can't control. And now the new HBO series is somewhat the same idea, but it's also more about, oh, this sort of elite humans creating this whole society and culture and life form. What happens when that life form decides, oh, we don't want to be controlled by you anymore? And that's an even more complex narrative. And so being able to see the contemporary Westworld and comparing it to the older Westworld, you get to see, oh, how have people's concerns changed about robotics? And then how are they kind of the same?
You're also including the animated film WALL-E on the 7th. That's going to be at 7 p.m.
So WALL-E is great because it kind of brings things full circle with Forbidden Planet. WALL-E is not malevolent at all. He's a servant.
He's adorable.
Yeah, he's adorable. He's a servant. And the one film that's somewhat optimistic, there's a lot of dire messages about maintaining the Earth and everything like that. But the story of WALL-E himself is that a robot that was built for one intention, right, to clean up our mess, winds up being the person, the character that saves humanity and saves the natural world, right? And so this is the important thing to remember, I think, is that we always worry about creating something and it having unexpected results. So that happens with most science fiction films, talking about computers or talking about robots. But often, yeah, we don't know what's going to happen. We have these things come into our lives, but that just because we don't know what's going to happen doesn't mean the unexpected is going to be bad either. It could be unexpected is, oh yeah, we create these tools that are supposed to help us, but then we don't even understand the possibility or what they could do to help us in the future. We don't really know what the final result or relationship will be. And so WALL-E is great in that respect, as it just kind of has that message that, oh yeah, technology, we should fear it maybe, but we should also invest some hope in it, which we do. I think we always do.
Later on the 7th at 10 p.m., you're going to be showing that great 80s film, RoboCop.
RoboCop, yes, is definitely the dark side. But what's also really interesting about RoboCop is those same ideas about creating a life form that we see in Blade Runner, but this is the case where we have someone who dies and then is sort of reanimated with part of their soul, maybe part of their humanity, but incorporated within a machine. And that's really, I think, the movie that connects the most to our near future, where we're going to become more and more hybrid creatures. You know, we already have artificial limbs and artificial organs. And so that idea of enhancing the human body, and then when does something stop being human and start becoming machine? That issue, I think, is going to start becoming more and more contentious and upfront and a real life issue much sooner than we expect.
That's Rick Valentin, organizer of the Arts Tech Film Fest, Robots, with an exclamation point. It runs tonight through Friday at the Normal Theater. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The Arts Tech Film Festival also features multimedia installations and virtual reality demos by ISU Arts Technology students prior to each night's film showing. You're listening to Sound Ideas and the theme to Forbidden Planet.
Hi, I'm Allison Bailey. I've made a legacy gift to WGLT because I know my contributions will go toward keeping our community informed on local events and issues. I rely on Sound Ideas for local news coverage. GLT Datebook gives me behind-the-scenes information about new art exhibits, theater productions, and live performances in the listening area. Any of this sound like you? Join me in contributing during the WGLT Fund Drive and help pay for everything GLT does with your first-time contribution. Click on Donate at WGLT.org.
It's fundraising time at GLT, but instead of taking 20 minutes out of every hour to ask for your financial support, we're only taking 30 seconds. Sound Ideas and everything else GLT provides is entirely dependent upon listeners' financial support. Make your contribution right now at WGLT.org. I'm Mike McCurdy at Sound Ideas. The School of Theater and Dance at Illinois State University is presenting the play Heresy of Love at Westhoff Theater. It's the story of a 17th century Mexican woman who was a poet, playwright, philosopher, and Catholic nun. Sor Juana Inez de la Cruz was a woman ahead of her time whose feminist struggles in her own day reflect some of the challenges women still face today. GLT's Judy Valente has more with the play's director.
She disguised herself as a male hoping to study at a university. She said women can, quote, perfectly well philosophize while cooking supper. Once denounced by the Catholic hierarchy, Sor Juana is now hailed in her native Mexico as a national hero. She's been the subject of novels, a Netflix miniseries, a telenovela, and currently the play Heresy of Love at Illinois State University's Westhoff Theater. Director Robert Quinlan says Sor Juana's unique life deserves all the attention she can get.
She is somebody who had a voracious curiosity, an appetite for knowledge. She was said to have one of the largest libraries in Mexico during her lifetime. And she was really just fascinated by every subject. She wanted to learn everything she could possibly learn and make connections between different disciplines. In some ways, I think she did that more than other scholars of the time because she wasn't formally educated. So she was able to pick up books and make discoveries and connections that other people weren't making at that time.
You're here with a dramaturg for your show, Heresy of Love, Treasure Davis. Treasure, how is it that this obscure nun who lived so many centuries ago entered the consciousness of contemporary people?
She was always there, and scholars have picked up on her work, and there's just something really fascinating about her, especially when we live in this political spectrum of people feeling silenced. Women feel silenced in a lot of ways, and Sor Juana fought against that. She found ways to connect her studies to her faith, and that was really empowering.
How is it that she was able to go after this knowledge at that time when women weren't even allowed to be educated?
Well, she talks about being born with this gift that she didn't even really understand. She was taught to read by somebody else's tutor. She just kind of hung out with a tutor that taught her to read, and then the rest of her education was done on her own. She did ask her mother if she could dress as a boy to attend school, and she was told no.
She predated Yentl in that way.
Yeah. That's right. But she wrestled with it, but as a devout Catholic too. She sought to understand why she was given this appetite for knowledge, and to reconcile that with her faith. And that's one thing that the play deals with, is how do you have a spiritual life and a creative life at the same time?
Well, that's what I want to ask you. A couple of things, though. First, Treasure, how is it then that she did get some formal education? Who stepped in, if anybody, to give her that opportunity?
Her grandfather actually had an extensive library, and so she started reading those books, and she ended up gaining the attention of the viceroy and vicerine, and she entered into the court. And as a member of court, she was given a lot of access to things that she wouldn't have otherwise. And she was encouraged to write. The people of the court loved reading what she had to write. So because there was kind of a market for her work, she was allowed access to things that other people may not have.
Robert, you made reference just now to the tension between education and spirituality. Mm. Now, how did she decide to go into religious life? Was she forced into that, or did she see that as a way of allowing her to continue studying?
Well, nobody really knows. You know, the biographical information on her is sketchy. So playwrights or screenwriters interpret those details as they will. One thought is that she had a romantic relationship that ended badly, and she decided to go into the cloistered convent. There is also some thought that she really wanted the seclusion, but nobody really knows. It is interesting, though, that she was writing secular plays and poetry in the court and writing for the vicereign. Her plays are comedies. They deal with romance and sexual intrigue. And so you can kind of understand why some of the priests and bishops at the time were scandalized by the subject of her writing.
Well, first, she is a Carmelite nun,
which
is basically, even today, a cloistered nun. And then she goes into this order called the Hieronymites. How'd she end up in the Carmelites? And then what was the draw of the Hieronymites?
She was a member of the Carmelites for a year, and illness went through the convent. And it isn't really, historically, there is no proof of why she left. But we do know that she did have some more freedom to write. And so she fell into this kind of place where she was able to read and she was able to write.
Well, what was the Hieronymite order? What did it stand for?
Learning
and knowledge. Yeah, there was this sense of trying to understand theology.
So it was a life where she could really actively pursue her intellectual curiosities.
Your play, Heresy of Love, does it focus on a particular point in her life?
It really looks at the last few years of her life, in particular when this new archbishop, a very, very conservative archbishop, came to Mexico and took an interest in her and stopping her from writing.
An interest in quotes.
Yes. Yeah, he's quite, the character is fascinating. It's a real character from history. The Archbishop Aguijari Cejas was his name. And it was during the Inquisition, and he was a hardliner. So he really did not believe that people should be pursuing secular entertainments of any kind. In fact, at one point in the play, he says, if they want entertainment, they can go to the auto de fe and watch the changing lights of burning men in flames.
So
he's pretty serious about his point of view. What I love about the play, though, is that it doesn't really take sides. You know, like if you listen to the archbishop, you can understand where he's coming from and why he has this pure belief that to save souls, you really need to keep people from these kinds of secular sins.
Treasure, an interesting fact is that she signs letters in which she renounces her work and calls herself at one point the worst of all people. Am I getting that?
The worst of all the world.
The worst of all the world. Isn't that kind of a sad ending for her?
It is. A lot of the things she talks about within the play are pulled from actual historical documents. So we have Sor Juana's letters. As far as her finally renouncing the things that she did, that's up for debate as well. I think that's the intrigue of writing about Sor Juana, because there are people who say that she never truly did renounce those things. She did burn her book. She did never write again. But things were found after she had passed that showed that she kind of held on to some of this stuff. So,
and maybe she was forced to write those letters. Isn't that another interpretation of what happened?
Yes.
Right. Many people know of her because of her poetry. The Latin American poet, the late Latin American poet Octavio Paz, has made her work much more widely known. What was it about her poetry that captured people's imagination?
Her poetry was seductive, which for someone in her position, you wouldn't think that that was there. But there is just such beauty in her language. It's beautiful. There's love and these real emotions. And she studied everything. She attributed what she sought out to learn to her relationship with God. So how can I understand all of these things in the Bible if I don't understand how everything works? And so that's all there. That beauty is there.
In the play, she says that in order to fully appreciate and understand theology, she also has to have an understanding of the human heart.
For both of you, what would you like a contemporary audience to take away about this 17th century figure?
I would love audiences to walk away and simply reflect on their own sense of faith and what they think about whether it's okay to censor someone. It's funny, when we started the rehearsal, it happened to be the day when Elizabeth Warren had to stop speaking on the Senate floor, and there was a hashtag, nevertheless, she persisted. And I went into rehearsal, and it was almost, there are almost lines in the play that are, nevertheless, she persisted. In fact, it could be an alternate title for the play. Mm-hmm. And so I think, I guess, to reflect on why women continue to be silenced in our society.
For me, being able to kind of reflect on someone like Sor Juana and imagine the bits and pieces and fill in the blanks, I would love to see people just take that idea and run with it. Like, who inspires you?
There is one line in the play that I love, and she says, "Why should our faith fear knowledge? For knowledge comes from him, and without it, we would be as the beasts wading through the mud and slime."
Well, certainly it's a message for our day. We've been talking with Robert Quinlan and Treasure Davis. He is the director and she is the dramaturg for the production at ISU's Westhoff Theater of Heresy of Love. Thank you so much for coming in and talking about this fascinating woman.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
Helen Edmondson's play, Heresy of Love, directed by Robert Quinlan, is on stage at ISU's Westhoff Theater through April 8th. Performances are at 7:30 p.m. You're listening to an arts, theater, and music edition of Sound Ideas, and this is the music of Mojo Stew. It'll be a major musical flashback Saturday night for those who were part of the Central Illinois musical scene in the 1980s and 90s. The Something Brothers, Mojo Stew, and the Mechanics reunite at the Castle Theater in a benefit show for Denny DeBourbon, who managed or booked all three bands back in the day. Bill Porter is Mojo Stew's guitarist. He tells GLT's John Norton via Skype that the reunion is for a great cause and that everyone is excited to play the show.
It's going to be all the original people. John Meyer on drums flew in from California. Monica Morris on vocals came in from Indiana. Gerard Montague, Michael Hill, and myself live here in town, along with our sound man, Don Shurick, who's going to mix us. So it was great just hanging around everybody and telling old stories and laughing and hearing that sound that only five unique individuals can make, and then having Don there to help with the engineering and the mixing and everything. It was really a nice flashback, and that's what we think this whole evening is going to be, is just kind of like a big, almost like a big high school reunion where we're going to see all our old friends from the 80s, and, you know, can't wait to see everybody.
For those people who really didn't know Mojo Stew, maybe they didn't live in town, could you give us a brief synopsis? How long was Mojo Stew a band? And, you know, how did you guys all get together in the first place?
We were a band from about 86 to 91. And Monica and Michael and I had played in an R&B band together, so we knew of each other. And that band broke up, and we were looking for something to do. Michael Hill and I have... I think the first time we played together was at Watterson Towers in my dorm room in like 1973 or 74. So we needed a drummer, and John Morris had gotten back off the road out west along with Monica. And so it's like, well, here's the good core of the band. So we started working up a bunch of R&B stuff, and people seemed to like it. It was very danceable and funky and bluesy. And we thought, something's missing, though. And after jamming with various people on saxophone and harmonica and stuff, this guy walks on stage with a saxophone, and I knew him because I had done sound for Ron LaSalle's band at Scotty's, and it was Gerard Montague on saxophone, and the guy just played great and looked great. I thought, but what's this guy going to be like, you know? And it turns out he's the nicest guy with the funniest sense of humor, and he's got stories from playing all over America with bands. And so we all just kind of got to be friends, and we had a good chemistry together. And you know, one thing led to another, and we started getting booked at better and better gigs. We played all over the Midwest, and eventually we wound up out in California on Natalie Cole's Big Break show, which was really a thrill for me after seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. I thought, you know, God has been very kind to me and the band, so we had a lot of fun.
Fresh from their hot live concerts throughout the Midwest, they came to Big Break just to sing for you. Please welcome Mojo Stew.
Well, Well, we're listening to the clip from The Big Break, that talent competition you mentioned that was hosted by Natalie Cole. And that was sort of, boy, one of your highlights of being Mojo, Stu. But you had a lot of highlights with that band. And you guys, and I was asking the Something Brothers the same thing, they just never quite made it, you know, and they were good enough. Mojo Stu was good enough. I know he got close to being signed by Alligator Records. What were you being told at the time by the people in the business? Did you need to do something? Did you need to do something else? What were they advising you to do to get to that next big level? Do you remember?
We worked with a lot of really good producers that all taught us a lot of stuff. Over the years, we refined our look and we kind of went through some different things. When we first started, it was still coming on the kind of the tails of Prince. And so we wore leather and stuff like that and kind of had that Minneapolis sound. I had just come off the road with a band that was signed in Minneapolis. So as far as the look evolving, we went to more of an urban contemporary. But then we found success playing the blues circuit. And so that's why Alligator started hooking us up with people like Joanna Connor and Lonnie Brooks and Big Daddy Kinsey and the Kinsey Report. And I forget, there were so many that we opened for. It was so neat to be a part of that, the whole Chicago music scene. But what was lacking, they couldn't categorize us because we had the funk thing going on and we had the blues thing going on, and we didn't want to be limited in just to one format or style. So ultimately, we couldn't decide which direction to go, just be a blues band, which was working and we were really successful, or try to aspire bigger now that we had that taste of L.A. and the Natalie Cole show. And then ironically, after we broke up, Dave Matthews comes on the scene with a saxophone player and a funky, it's like, doggone it.
Well, we're talking with Bill Porter of Mojo Stu. The band is reuniting with the Something Brothers and the Mechanics April 8th at the Castle Theater. And I'm sure that looking back is natural with this upcoming show. Bill, what kind of memories are bubbling up for you, have bubbled up for you and the others in the band?
Oh, it's just been so fun remembering some of the funny things that I had forgotten and somebody else will remember. And it's like, oh, yeah, that did happen. We went down to Nashville and recorded at the University of Tennessee or whatever it is down there. And that was really neat, being able to see, you know, Nashville. That was such a music city. And it was, I mean, I'm from the Chicago area, and Chicago, of course, is a music city big time with the blues and everything. Nashville's got a whole different scene. Then we went out to Los Angeles. That's got a different scene. We played a lot in St. Louis, and, you know, that the blues, it's a whole different kind of a bluesy sound, but a wonderful scene. We played in Quad Cities a lot. You know, the river towns have a certain bluesy vibe to it. It was just neat traveling around and meeting different people and finding out the way that they do things maybe is not the way that you do it. And it's like, oh, well, you're wrong. It's like, no, wait a minute, that's a better way to do it. So it really is kind of a mind expanding thing, and it just so fun riding around in the bus. Michael and Gerard would be listening to Frank Sinatra and laughing in the backseat.
Well,
and John, we called him Kingpin because he was the leader. He had a bag phone, and we thought that was really cool because he could talk to our manager while we were on the road.
That was John?
Yeah, John. John was the leader of the band as far as the business.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned how Mojo Stu probably didn't get to that next level because you couldn't quite decide exactly what you wanted to do. The Something Brothers pretty much told me the same thing. Is like, man, we were there doing this, we were doing that. We're kind of all over the place, but we're all in that kind of rock umbrella. And they said the same thing happened to them. That's really interesting. Well, another thing that I asked Tommy and Ed of the Something Brothers, I want to ask of you to wrap this up. How difficult is it going to be for you guys to come up with a set list for this show?
Well, we've already put together a set list, and we've already had a couple of practices.
Okay.
And it was so cool hearing that sound again after all those years. And there were so many songs. Like I say, we had several sets of originals. And going back and listening to them, I had forgotten how complex out they were, some of the bridges and the parts that we put in there. And it's like, holy smokes, how in the world did I figure this? So for me, it was more like, how did I do that? So the memory banks are a little foggy.
You really did have some game back then, huh?
Yeah, and we've got CDs to prove it. So we're going to have both of our CDs are going to be available if anybody wants a stroll down memory lane.
When Randy, who's working with the Something Brothers, he let me know about this about a month and a half ago. And I'm like, are you kidding me? This is going to be huge. And I'm guessing you're getting the same vibe from all the people you're hearing, too.
Oh, yeah. I'm getting stopped on as I go around town or whatever. People say, hey, what's up with that? It's going to be really, really fun. It's only $12 to get in. That's for all three bands. So, I mean, we're not trying to gouge anybody. We just want to see everybody again and hang out and remember good times at Scotty's and Mosey's and all the places we used to hang out way back then, you know? Yeah, come on down. It should be a blast.
Bill Porter of Mojo Stew is talking via Skype with GLT's John Norton. This Saturday at the Castle in Bloomington, Mojo Stew, the Something Brothers, and the Mechanics are reuniting for a benefit for Denny DeBourbon, who managed or booked all three bands. Doors open at 7 p.m. Music is scheduled to begin at 8. You're listening to Little Brother Mojo Stew on Sound Ideas.
Can you feel a brother? Can you see?
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find John Norton's interviews at WGLT.org along with the rest of today's show. Thanks to Laura Kennedy and Judy Valente. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas and the interviews you hear. Share your thoughts about the show at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.